From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From 1915 to 1970, more than 6 million African Americans left the South for northern cities in what came to be known as the Great Migration. That move by one family is the starting point for the new novel, The 12 Tribes of Hattie, by first-time author Ayanna Mathis. It's an intimate, child-by-child look at the Shepherd family and the mother, Hattie, who led it across a tumultuous century. It's turning a lot of heads. This hour on Point, Ayanna Mathis and the 12 Tribes of Hattie. Joining me now from New York is author Ayanna Mathis. She's author of the new novel, The 12 Tribes of Hattie. Oprah popped it into her new book club, and it's been buzzing ever since. Ayanna Mathis, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you with us.
Oh, Tom, it's such a pleasure to be here. I'm so happy about it.
We've got a lot to talk about with you, but would you be kind enough first to introduce us to the mother of all the tribes in your book? Introduce us to Hattie Shepherd, your creation.
Hattie is a very complicated woman. As you said, she comes from Georgia in 1923. She leaves with her family of a somewhat privileged family, and something horrible happens, as things were wont to happen in the Deep South in those years. Her father is killed, and so she and her mother and two sisters leave kind of in the pre-dawn, you know, sort of escape through the woods from their home, and they get on a train and they come to Philadelphia. And Hattie arrives there when she's only 15, and then not very long after.
With the mud of Georgia still on the hem of her skirt, you write.
Indeed. Indeed, it was, as was the case with many sort of leavings during the time of the Great Migration, it wasn't necessarily a very glamorous one. You know, they basically had to escape. And they take a train journey from Philadelphia, from Georgia to Philadelphia, a fairly harrowing one, but also one that is illuminating to Hattie in certain kinds of ways. And she arrives in Philadelphia within 2 years. So by the time she's 17, she marries, and she has her first two children who meet an unfortunate end. And then Hattie goes on to have 9 other children. So she has a total of 11 children in total, and all of them born in Philadelphia. And she is a woman who is capable and has a deep, deep wellspring of love for these children, but is, because of the tragedy that befalls her so early in her life, it becomes really unable to show tenderness and to show warmth and to show affection. So she really does raise them with a kind of iron fist and a kind of hardness that is both damaging to her and is damaging to her children. She's somewhat of a larger-than-life figure, I think, at the same time that she is a very kind of quotidian figure. You know, she's a homemaker. Mm-hmm. She's a mother in a house, which is not necessarily a figure is certainly a figure that we can all kind of relate to and understand.
I think part of what's turning heads on your book, Ayanna, is the kind of intimacy and nuance that you share with us of the experience of these characters, Hattie and her children and a grandchild who makes it 12, ultimately. I'd love to get just a sense of that. There's a little bit here in the book, The 12 Tribes of Hattie. Just after she and her mother and sister arrive in Philadelphia, she's just off the train, sort of pushed away from them in the crowd. And suddenly she's on a sidewalk of Philadelphia, just outside the train station. There's a flower peddler, which seems like a totally ordinary thing. But from this very young woman from the South, the nature of the interaction between the white peddler and the African-American woman stepping up to buy flowers is a revelation. I wonder if you would read from that for us.
Happily. A cart at the end of the sidewalk caught her eye. Hattie had never seen a flower vendor's cart. A white man sat on a stool with his shirt sleeves rolled and his hat tipped forward against the sun. Hattie set her satchel on the sidewalk and wiped her sweaty palms on her skirt. A Negro woman approached the cart. She indicated a bunch of flowers. The white man stood. He did not hesitate. His body didn't contort into a posture of menace, and took the flowers from a bucket. Before wrapping them in paper, he shook the water gently from the stems. The Negro woman handed him the money. Had their hands brushed? As the woman took her change and moved to put it in her purse, she upset 3 of the flower arrangements. Vases and blossoms tumbled from the cart and crashed onto the pavement. Hattie stiffened, waiting for the inevitable explosion. She waited for the other Negroes to step back and away from the object of the violence that was surely coming. She waited for the moment in which she would have to shield her eyes from the woman and whatever horror would ensue. The vendor stooped to pick up the mess. The Negro woman gestured apologetically and reached into her purse again, presumably to pay for what she'd damaged. In a couple of minutes, it was all settled, and the woman walked on down the street with her nose in the paper cone of flowers as if nothing had happened. Hattie looked more closely at the crowd on the sidewalk. The Negroes did not step into the gutters to let the whites pass, and they did not stare doggedly at their own feet. Four Negro girls walked by, teenagers, like Hattie, chatting to one another. Just girls in conversation, giggling and easy, the way only white girls walked and talked in the city streets of Georgia. Hattie leaned forward to watch their progress down the block. At last, her mother and sisters exited the station and came to stand next to her. "Mama," Hattie said, "I'll never go back. Never."
Ayanna Mathis reading from The 12 Tribes of Hattie. And here we are with this moment where she sees a culture so unlike the Georgia she's come from. And you're tempted to read that and say, oh, hallelujah, you know, the future is going to be magical here. And yet that's not the way it turns out. But just dwell with us for a second here. I mean, I guess we get it. But all the little points of revelation in that, what, the couple of minutes of observation on the sidewalk that you have her take on in Philadelphia, contrasted against what?
Contrasted, I think, against a very, very different reality. I mean, this is when this is occurring, we're in 1923. So at that time, there was obviously a very sort of solidified and intense racial caste system that existed in the South. And that racial caste system was maintained and through the use of extreme violence. You know, we're talking about a period in which lynchings were a near everyday occurrence at some part in the South. I'm not saying sort of in the same neighborhood, of course, but you know, lynchings and racial violence were constant. And so people, you know, Hattie's family, her father owned a blacksmith shop, and they owned their home. And so they were a very middle-class family. But the extent to which they could be middle-class and could enjoy the freedoms of being a middle-class family were, of course, severely limited, not just in terms of their ability to progress even further economically, but also in terms of their where they could live, what they could do. And, of course, Hattie's father is the reason that they flee the South is because Hattie's father is murdered. A group of men. The narrative in the story in the chapter doesn't go into it too much, but the idea is that there were a group of white men that were interested in his shop and didn't like that he was so successful, and so they murder him.
You write
and
about so his young daughter coming in. You say her father's body she saw collapsed in the corner of his smithy. Mm. The two white men from town walking away from his shop without enough shame to quicken their pace or hide their guns. Hattie had seen that, and she could not unsee it. I mean, part of the tension throughout here is that there's this ambivalence on the part of your African-American characters about the South. She says, I'll never go back. And yet we see characters in the process of most of a century unfolding here, feeling nostalgia, too, for that South left behind.
I think that's true. I mean, I think that particularly for that generation of people who left and then the generation of their children, there was a real sense of conflict about it. Hattie hates the South. I mean, she thinks it's a corrupt and corrupting place, a dangerous place. It killed her father. She hates it. But her husband, August, on the other hand, has a great deal of nostalgia for it. I think that the other children, though two of them do spend time there, their feelings about it are somewhat less clear. One, I think, Floyd feels a bit like it is a place where he is led too much to indulge certain proclivities about which he has a great deal of shame.
A traveling musician, a trumpeter with a lot of access to proclivities on the trumpeting circuit.
Exactly. I mean, he's gay, you know, but he really kind of can't deal with the fact that he's gay. And when he finds himself away for the first time, away from Philadelphia and away from his mother, he's an itinerant musician, you know, sort of trying to make his name as a trumpeter. And so he does this tour of like juke joints and places like that in the South. And he he finds that without the sort of constraints of his mother and his community in the North, and his community in the North is very particular. These people are enormously class conscious. They are very proper with a capital P, you know. And he finds himself suddenly away from all of that and unable to continue to rein in the, you know, his desire for men, which he's been able to rein in to some extent while he was in Philadelphia. And the other child that ends up in the South is, of course, Six, who is a later chapter, actually only the third, really. And Six ends up there because he's sort of done something that he shouldn't have done in Philadelphia. And he has an odd sort of religious gift for preaching. And so for him, it's kind of a place that he ends up running away from what he's done up North and staying there because it's easier for him in a certain kind of way.
Ayanna Mathis, please stand by. The new book is The 12 Tribes of Hattie, 11 Children, a Grandchild on All Kinds of Paths, out of the Great Migration of African Americans from South to North, covering most of a century. You can join the conversation. Have you read it? Are you in the middle of it still, the book? Do you see why it got Oprah excited? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. A little Duke Ellington to go out on, Work Song. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Yeah, yeah. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a big African-American family come north in the debut novel of Ayanna Mathis. Her book's getting a lot of buzz. It is The 12 Tribes of Hattie. Ayanna Mathis is with us from New York. Ayanna, this is not a triumphant migration. I mean, there is trouble aplenty. There's just a ton of sadness here. You're Hattie with her first two babies, Philadelphia and Jubilee, and they're up against pneumonia before they're even close to out of diapers. Just a world of trouble, child after child.
It is true. You know, the title of the book, The 12 Tribes, is a reference to the 12 tribes of the biblical 12 tribes of Israel. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I thought was interesting about migratory movements in general, of course, you know, this one about the Great Migration, but in general is that we invest, or generations that migrate invest, an enormous amount of hope and promise in what's going to happen when they get to this promised land, you know, and also in the way that the Israelites did. And then they kind of got there and things did not turn out the way that they had expected them to. There was a lot more trouble and a lot more strife than anyone thought there would be. And I think in a certain way, the book wants to explore the ways in which there sort of isn't a guarantee that things are going to go fine, and that though we may leave something more painful or more dangerous in the case of these characters behind us, there are certainly kind of dangers aplenty to brook when we get to where we're going.
Young Six, one of the children, one of the brothers, is scarred as a young man, burned. And he is an angry young man. He gets in trouble in Philly, has to go south in a hurry as a kind of preacher in the making. And you've got just a passage there, just a paragraph, a piece of one, where he's thinking about South and North and his attitudes as a young man now having been raised in Philadelphia toward each and the attitudes of people around him. Could you read just a bit for us there, Ayanna?
Sure. He, that is Six, this character. He thought of the South as a single, undifferentiated mass of states where the people talked too slow, like August, and left because of the whites, only to spend the rest of their lives being nostalgic for the most banal and backwoods things: paper shell pecans, sweet gum trees, gigantic peaches. August could recite the names of the people who lived in the town in which he grew up. In Georgia, he said, the old people never went untended. The North was cold and colorless. The food was awful and the people were desperate. When he talked that way, Hattie would fold her arms and press her lips together into a thin line.
That ambivalence about the South and Hattie, the mother, who's just not really going to say much about it.
She's just done with it. Hattie has a, you know, Hattie is a very absolute kind of a woman. One of the kind of great things about August is that he is able to sort of see nuance and to sort
her
of understand
August.
That everything is not, you know, one thing or the other. Hattie is not that way. It is good. It is bad. And that's it.
Where did you draw your inspiration for this angle on the Great Migration and the life that followed? Is this something out of your own family experience? Is this your sort of consensus reading of the African-American experience? Do you intend it for us to look at this as singular? Where does it come from?
I absolutely do intend for us to look at it as singular. I don't think it's a kind of sort of symphonic or definitive novel about the Great Migration. That wasn't my intention at all. I think my intention first and foremost was to write about this particular family and these particular people and how they lived their experience, both as migrants and as first-generation Philadelphians. I think the story is very, very, very particular to them and to their specific experience, though, of course, they are a Great Migration family, and of course, that plays a role in it. Hattie herself is very loosely kind of inspired by my own grandmother, who was not a woman who was anywhere near as angry as Hattie is, but certainly came from the South herself, and though never kind of talked about it. You know, I grew up, by the time I kind of came on the scene in the 70s, everyone was so far removed from the South that it was not a thing that was ever discussed. It kind of wasn't a part of my upbringing in any way. Mm-hmm. But what did happen, I think, is that I grew up with my grandmother around, and who was a fascinating woman to me and also a really stoic woman. And in many ways, you know, she was sort of impossible to understand without Hattie's anger and coldness. But Hattie, as I said, inspired by her very loosely. I think they're quite different women, but she is also, I think, an attempt to kind of figure out what was happening in there, you know, what was happening inside the kind of brain and soul and heart of this person.
I read the details with enormous interest, and you described many of them so wonderfully. I really enjoyed that. At the same time, of course, you can't help but look for sort of the theme or your judgment. I mean, especially when you take such a huge sweep of time here from 1925 to, 1980 or beyond. I mean, start out in the soundtrack maybe, I don't know, as gospel and pre-Duke Ellington, and by the end of your story, or, you know, you're getting through Stevie Wonder and Marvin Gaye and well beyond. But this is not a redemption song. This is decade on decade of trouble. And here we are reading it, you know, in years when you've got an African-American family in the White House, and yes, there are a lot of things unsolved, but surely there's been a lot of progress as well. And I wonder how the sadness of these stories plays in your mind as the author against the reality, or at least the sort of high points that get a lot of attention around us these days.
I think two things about that. First is that I think that it's very important to sort of understand these people as not merely I never wanted them to be understood purely through the prism of race, which is why I hope very much and I think very much that they are characters that are accessible to black people, certainly, but also
beyond.
To kind of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
Their troubles and their sadness at the beginning of the book are very, very specifically racial, I think. But as you move, and this was very kind of consciously done, as you move through the arc of time and you get toward 1980, their problems become problems that are kind of caused by their ways of being. You know, I think of Belle who comes later in the book in 1975, and she's just sort of ornery and difficult just because that's how she is, you know?
Very
and so
ornery.
They
wow.
also are...
Yeah.
What did you say? I'm sorry.
Very ornery indeed.
She's, I mean, really, you know, she's, and I mean, I like her very much, but she certainly is ornery.
Yeah.
And a lot of the problems that the characters begin to encounter in their sadness becomes about the kind of emotional legacy that they get from Hattie, which is one of isolation and one of kind of doing things by yourself on your own and not talking about anything with anybody. And also those sadnesses and those problems come from their own very specific personalities and very specific pathologies, and also from a kind of, I think, more general sort of human, I don't know, ennui, you know? I mean, they are sort of suffering from a kind of very human malaise, you know? So I think in one sense there is that. And to relate it very specifically back to your question, I think one of the ideas that I had in writing the book was I wanted to create these characters that were seen as fully human and that their racial identities were a part of that continuum of their humanity in general. Mm-hmm. And I think that we are sort of getting to a place as a nation where we can do that, you know, where we can begin to have discussions about Black people and about the Black community that are not hyper-racialized always.
Yes.
And that is not in any way to sort of negate, you know, problems of racism and the enormous problems and challenges that we still face. But that, you know, if anything, you know, all of these incredible men and women who left the South in the Great Migration, all the incredible women, men and women who lost lives and who gave so much in the civil rights movement, part of that was so that we could have a kind of freedom of thought and freedom of artistry, aside from the, you know, all the sort of legal stuff that we needed to do. There was this other sort of dimension of freedom that I feel like someone who is writing in my generation and writing contemporarily can kind of write a pre-civil rights story with a post-civil rights sensibility, which is very much what I've tried to do.
You know, that story is kind of around. We've spoken with Isabel Wilkerson here with her wonderful book, The Warmth of Other Suns, which you cite. Toni Morrison was with us not so long ago and talking about her latest book, Home, talking about a different kind of journey. You cite both of them as inspirations here. You're very explicit saying, look, this migration from the South was not just to escape economic woe or the literally the lash or the threat of lynching. It was a flight toward away from dehumanization, toward living fully humanly. But absolutely. Then here you are. You take them, you give them that chance, and then it's boom, just one kind of collapse after another. So, okay, fully human. You want to be fully human? Try this out. See how you like this. Not exactly a joyride.
Well, because I don't think, and here we go, I'm probably revealing too much about myself. But, I mean, I think that being fully human is a pretty mingled thing, you know? And I don't think that being fully human necessarily means being happy, per se. I think that that failure is a part of being a full human being, and grappling with your failures is a part of being a full human being. And I also, I suppose this is just my own sort of strange sensibility, there's a great, I find happiness and beauty probably in very strange places. That there's a passage later on that I don't know if I'm going to read or not, but there's a passage later on in a book called Ella, when Hattie gives away her last born child, when she recalls the train journey from Georgia to Philadelphia. And it was really, you know, kind of harrowing and awful and humiliating on many levels. But she has this moment when she's in this train, when she is suddenly completely aware of her inviolate self, you know, of her personhood, and that she is a distinct human being on this earth, distinct from all other human beings, which seems to me a really incredible and magical moment. And I have tried as much as I could to give these characters moments like that.
Read that for us.
Like that, of some kind of beauty.
Yeah, if you've got it, Ayana, if you can put your hands on it, read that passage for us.
Sure. Now I have to flip around for the page. I think
that's all right. It's your book. You'll find it.
I will indeed. I have these things marked, but I felt. Look
good,
at that.
Good.
Such efficiency.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. There were no bathrooms in the Jim Crow train cars when Hattie and her sisters and mother left Georgia in 1923, and many of the southern stations didn't have Negro restrooms, so they had to go outside. Three stood watch while the fourth relieved herself. The first time, Hattie couldn't go for the shame of it. Her mother went last, and the white conductor yelled at them from a few yards up the track, "Y'all better come on if you're coming." What an outrage it was to see her mother, who was never without her hair done up in a bun, who could have passed for white but wouldn't, who was more mannered and proper than the Queen of England, squatted in the kudzu with her skirt around her waist and a white man bellowing at her. That same conductor stood waiting for them at the entrance to the Negro car a few minutes later. He had his hands in his pockets and swayed on his heels, watching them walk along the track toward him. He winked at Mama. He pressed his body into theirs as they climbed up into the car. Hattie's Mama said nothing, but she flushed crimson at her neck, and her breath came in angry bursts. After that, they'd gone to the bathroom only when one of them was nearly doubled over from the pain of holding it. It was a terrible trip. though something astonishing had happened. Hattie woke in the middle of the night to the clack of the wheels on the track and the rain rapping against the window, the opaque purple sky a dome against which the trees pressed. The journey had lifted her out of the plainness of her life. In Georgia, she was one of many, undifferentiated from others, even in her own mind. But on the train to Philadelphia, she became acutely aware of what was inviolate in her. She felt herself a single red flower in a field of green grass.
Ayanna Mathis reading from The 12 Tribes of Hattie. A wonderful passage. Jim's calling from Buffalo, New York. Jim, you're on the air with Ayanna Mathis. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Ayanna. Excellent discussion, and boy, does the book draw you in as she talks about it. I wanted to point out something about this great migration, mm-hmm. and that not only was it there the escape from the terribleness in which they lived and towards a hopeful future, but also I think we see a disconnect that continues today, that as they ran from where they were going to come to the new place, the promised land, that while they focus a lot on the pain and the terribleness, but didn't transfer the skills. And I say that in regards to today. When I look at how many people have come north, and some who talk about going back, but the skills that they had back there, the mastery of the land, they haven't shown it up here in our northern cities. That in our northern cities, the great history and wealth of how to work the land that exists in our grandmothers and foreparents, that who many are still here, hasn't translated into our younger population. So,
Jim, forgive me, but if I may, wasn't it in a way poured into just a different setting? I mean, look at the factories of the auto industry in this period.
Kind of, sort of, but you would think that even as the factories evolved, the skills and the needs for how to work the natural land around you, how to be self-sufficient, because even within the confinery of slavery, they had to learn how to work the land for survival, not dependent just on the master, but learning other ways of coping.
I mean, that's pretty tough, though, when you're in a very inner city area, which sooner or later seemed to become already a slum. I don't know, but pick it up, please, Ayanna. Jim, thank you for that observation. What about that sense of mastery that clearly many African Americans had, not in power terms, but in the work terms in the South? What about that in the migration, Ayanna?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, I think certainly, you know, there's sort of the obvious point, which is that, you know, I mean, if you were in Detroit or Chicago or even Philadelphia, there wasn't really any kind of land to work, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing that's sort of going on is that, you know, if in the migration time period and going back before that, certainly you may have had a little plot of land. I mean, you're sort of the control of your body and the control of your wealth, your possibility to make money and all that was absolutely out of your hands. But certainly you could sort of till a little plot of land maybe somewhere and grow, you know, potatoes or sweet potatoes or whatever it was that you were growing. And in the North, I wonder if it's not so much that there was a failure to transfer those skills or to bring those skills.
Hard to do on a city street. Ayanna, hold the thought. We're going to take a short break here. The new book is The 12 Tribes of Hattie. Marvin Gaye is right there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. 800-423-8255. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with debut novelist Ayanna Mathis. Her first book, is The 12 Tribes of Hattie, about a big family coming north out of the South, African-American family. Well, starts with just a few, grows large in the North, many children, and their lives through decade after decade of the 20th century, the decades of the Great Migration. Don in Windsor, Connecticut. Thanks for calling. Don, you're on the air with Ayanna.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hello, Ayanna. Nice to talk to you. I'm really wondering, in listening to your description of the book, it sounds to me very much in parallel to the early plays of August Wilson and his Century Cycle. I'm thinking of Gem of the Ocean and Joe Turner's Come and Gone. And I'm wondering to what extent Wilson may have been an influence on Ayanna.
Thanks, Tom.
Oh, that's a great question. I can honestly say, sort of aside from, I don't read an enormous amount of plays. I think certainly he is within the sort of incredible cultural and artistic legacy from which I have drawn. But I don't know that he was necessarily a direct influence.
You write about Toni Morrison, about Rita Dove, her collection Thomas and Ballul. Of course, Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns.
Sure.
It's an interesting story how you picked this up. I mean, you didn't exactly dive straight into this right out of short pants here. You were all over the place, spent years living in Italy, came back to the States, I think did more poetry in early years, and ended up with the seed of this at the Iowa Writers' Workshop for, a couple of years?
Yeah.
How did it blossom, Ayanna?
Well, it's sort of a funny story. There's the kind of practical way in which things happen, which was that I thought that I was going to, before I got to Iowa, I had begun work on I guess you would call it a memoir, but it was sort of a mess and it wasn't very good. And so I decided to fictionalize it. And then, and that's what I applied to Iowa with and went to Iowa with. And then my first semester there, it's a 2-year program, as you said, my first semester there, I took this, you know, about 25 pages of this fictionalized-ish memoir-like thing into workshop with Marilyn Robinson, who was one of my teachers and has become very, very important to me, both as a writer and personally. And basically it sort of got the thumbs down, which I knew that it had a lot of issues. And so I began, I thought, well, you know, I can either kind of spend the rest of my 2 years here having, you know, a massive crisis, or I can figure out something. I guess I'll write some stories. And so the stories that I began to write were about these people. I didn't necessarily realize at first that they were in the same family, but they kept being sort of in the 40s or 50s, and then I realized that they were in the
siblings.
Same family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And off we go. Don, thanks for your call. Maybe more Toni Morrison and Rita Dove than August Wilson in this one. Maybe. Sally in Surfside Beach, South Carolina. Sally, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Ayanna Mathis.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great to be here. I was raised in the West, and had a biracial marriage, and we ended up having a tribe of our own that is scattered all over the country. Mm-hmm. But what I learned when I was married was the stories of my husband's family, and some of them were just so tragic, things that you could never, ever conceive of. And usually grandma or great-grandma or auntie would never, ever, ever talk about these things because they knew that if these stories passed their lips, their children would develop a hatred that would make it almost impossible for them to just move on.
Mm-hmm.
So they kept them secrets. And
did they stay secret?
No, they came out usually before the person died. You know, the person would explain what happened to them. And particularly when Obama was being inaugurated, there was just this incredible feeling of it was all worth it. You know, everything everybody did during the civil rights, everything everybody, you know, all the fact that grandma couldn't walk her whole life because somebody deliberately drove over her.
Right.
All of those stories were just like, well, here it is. And one of the problems that I see in going on and this book seems to really touch on that, is what happens to those sad stories is a new generation looks on to almost as though we're starting right now.
Sally, let us pick it up, if I may. I think we've got enough to work with there, and it's rich. Ayanna, I wonder what you're thinking as you hear this, because, you know, you said earlier families often begin migrations with high hopes. And I'm sure that's no doubt true, but you know from your own story, and it sounds as Sally may have a bit of the same, migrations also often have begun in sorrow or desperation. Mm-hmm. We must go for whatever reason, hunger or oppression or you name it. And there are often very sad stories back in the family trunk. And I wonder about the energy of those. I mean, in your story, Hattie personifies a lot of anger and sorrow along the way. whether she talks about it to her children or not, whether she tells the stories or not, she breathes this pain. There's a point well into the book where she says, here we are, she's thinking to herself, here we are 60 years out of Georgia. A new generation has been born, and there's still the same wounding and the same pain. What have you thought about what gets carried along in the pain closet and what gets or should be left behind, Anna?
I think, you know, one of the things I was really interested in doing with these characters was it's sort of one of the reasons that we meet them so often at some very particular and critical moment of their lives is because I was interested in the ways in which we carry around our personal histories, our racial histories, our class histories, our psychology, all of it, our sort of sad stories in the family trunk, as you so nicely put it. But that those things often don't necessarily come into play in a kind of very daily sort of way. They're sort of swearing around in the ethers of our family histories and of our lives, but that they seem to be put very directly, very actively into play at moments of real crises. And I think that's what happens a lot with the people in this book. And I think, though, that the other thing that happens is that we can get to a place where there is a possibility of redemption. You know, I mean, this book is not about redemption, but it certainly is, which I think sometimes can be a fairly easy sentiment or can be arrived upon cheaply. And I didn't want to do that here. I don't think that people necessarily jettison all of what was bad. I think that they learned how to incorporate it and how to use it in a way that is at least not damaging, if not in some ways helpful. You know, when Hattie gets to that part at the end of the book when you were talking about, you know, when she says, you know, sort of all this wounding 60 years out of Georgia, the sort of the next thing she does in the next few pages after she says that is rescue her granddaughter from what she feels is a real sort of giving into the pain. She pulls her back. She says, I won't allow it. And that is both Hattie's personal redemption, and it is an indication that it is possible to save somebody despite the wounding, or perhaps because of the wounding, you can save someone. You can incorporate it. You can grow. You can become richer for it in some kind of way.
Let's get a call. Sally, thank you. Let's get a call from Duane in New Orleans.
Thank you, Sally. It's a great question.
New Orleans, Louisiana. Duane's on the line. Hi, Duane. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I had a question. Just in doing a little bit of research and hearing different stories from the past, does the book at all – I didn't get a chance to read the book yet, and I'm sure it's a great book. I hope to read it. But does the book ever go into the understanding that the plight of African-American males when they came up north, many times not having the same jobs and not being able to provide for their families in the same way they were able to provide in the South to a certain extent, and the breakdown of family structure that some people say happened when they came up or weren't able to find the same kind of jobs that the mothers or the wives were able to find. And I just want to know if the story actually talks about some of those kind of things, or even what are your thoughts on that type of understanding?
Thanks for that question, Duane. Ayana?
It's a really interesting question. I think the book does to some extent. I mean, the important sort of thing to know about the book, I think, is that it is enormously character-driven, right? So it begins from its foundation is the people in it as opposed to kind of issues. But certainly in this book, they are going through an enormous amount of economic hardship. And August in particular is both out of an inability to find the kind of work that would better support the family.
August is the father in the family,
August
the husband
the father.
Of Hattie.
Sorry about that. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tim. Mm-hmm. And also out of his sort of inability to find work, and also he's kind of a cad, you know. So he also has some faults as well that are going on there that inhibit his ability to be the kind of provider that he should be. And I think that it's interesting, you know, I think that, as I was saying, that the novel very much explores the ways in which people are kind of victims of themselves, you know what I mean, of their psychology and personality, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly also explores certain kinds of legacies and certain kinds of pathologies that existed because of displacement, because of rifted and broken families, because of all the economic hardships and all of that kind of stuff. And Hattie's the way in which we see Hattie sort of acting out, I guess, or manifesting is a better term, those things is her coldness and her anger and her hardness. And August's, I think, in a certain way, is his slight kind of caddishness. You know, he's a deeply loving man, but on some levels he just kind of can't and doesn't get it together. And I think both of them, in their very different ways, are reacting to their personal psychology, as I said, but also to the kind of larger societal things that were going on.
There's a point where Hattie's daughter Cassie has moved back in with her parents, and she's remembering maybe one of these moments that sticks with her, her mom in the kitchen, and these tensions. Could you read that passage for us, Ayanna?
Sure. I remembered mother in an apron in the kitchen of my childhood. I stood in the doorway. She tore the leaves from the stems of the collard greens and washed them in the double sink. Ham hocks simmered on the stove, the gas turned high and hissing beneath the pot. Now and again she stopped and stared out of the window, one hand dripping on her hip, and sighed. Sunlight shone on the side of her face. Her expression was soft and restless at the same time. Something wild was in that afternoon. It wafted through the kitchen like the music Daddy listened to after Mother sent us children to bed. Juke music crept up the stairs and into our rooms. It curled itself around us and vibrated like a purring cat against our bodies. That music gave us inklings of things we weren't supposed to know. My parents hardly spoke at all, hated each other, it seemed to me, but Saturday nights, after they'd had a fight, they went upstairs and closed the bedroom door. I thought of that music, too, when a woman in a tight dress sashayed in front of our porch one evening, all hips and swagger. Daddy liked women like that. I saw him with one when I was a teenager. They were all wrapped around each other in a parked car while Mother was at home doing what needed to be done. I don't blame her for being so angry, though I couldn't help but wonder if she regretted us. When that woman peacocked in front of our stoop, everyone but Mother and I clucked her tongue. Aunt Marion said the switching woman was loose, but I thought she was free. Mother washed the greens with a look on her face like she wanted to put on her own tight dress, walk out of the house, and never come back. Instead, she said, get the cordial out of the credenza. She poured herself a glass and sat at the kitchen table, sipping it. When it was gone, she turned the glass upside down and let the last drop fall onto her tongue. Mother was a beautiful young woman. The house was too plain, too small to contain her. I watched her. For the first time, I understood that she had an inner life that didn't have anything to do with me or my brothers or sisters. She smiled and nodded her head as if to a remembered melody.
Ayanna Mathis reading from the 12 Tribes of Hattie. Duane in New Orleans, I hope the poetry of that passage, the sentiments there, gives you a little bit of an answer to your question. And let me get one more, if I may. Carol in Lexington, Kentucky. Carol, you're on with Ayanna. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I am a child of this migration. My father just died last week, just on his 80th birthday. Mm. And what I find remarkable in hearing a lot of the stories about him since he's died is how many of the things that he did hold from me in an effort to protect me and make me able to go into the wider world with an open heart, things that before I might have been deemed a character flaw or just a silence or a moodiness, was really his way of shielding me from a lot of the struggle that he went through. And I think it's really important for those of us who are from this younger generation to get in there and find these things out so that you can have a better understanding of your family before it's too late.
Where did he come up from, Carol? What state?
He was born and raised in Alabama. He was in his second year of college and was drafted because at that time segregation prevented ROTC from being in college campuses.
Right.
That were historically black.
Carol, I appreciate your story, and I'm sorry for the loss of your father right here. I've just got a minute with Ayanna, but let me get her response. This withholding of the father, in Carol's case, up from Alabama, withholding to empower, to try to empower her. And now, Carol, thinking maybe we need to hear these stories. You've just written a whole book of them. Is that your sense, Ayanna? Let's hear it.
I, I certainly think so to some extent. You know, one of the things, and it's really interesting that she mentioned that, I think that there is a sense in which grandparents, aunts, uncles, the sort of older generation, very specifically and purposely did not tell the younger ones things in order to protect them. And I think that there is also a necessity, or is becoming necessity now that these things are less traumatizing, to talk about them. I think one of the things also that doesn't ever get talked about is class. And the issue of class in the Black community, and I think very much in our country in general, is a thing that's kind of like a no-go zone. Class is a big part of this book, and the ways in which class impacted and continues to impact are really substantial and profound.
Ayanna Mathis, I hope you keep tilling this field, this line. Maybe more on that theme itself. The new book is The 12 Tribes of Hatti. It's been really a pleasure talking with you, Ayanna. Good luck with it, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Tom. I really enjoyed being here.
Ayanna Mathis, The 12 Tribes of Hatti. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. We'll go out with Nina Simone, Feeling Good. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean. Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world in a bold world.